Hello and welcome to Tony Martinetti Nonprofit Radio, big nonprofit ideas for the other 95%. I'm your aptly named host. We're live from the Foundation Center in New York City. Oh, I'm glad you're with me. I'd be hit with dystichiasis if I saw that you doubled down on the idea that you missed today's show. How foundations make decisions. Data matters. It's our final show in Foundation Center month, looking at their annual report, measuring the state of disaster philanthropy. Foundation Center's Grace Sato explains the research her team creates and how foundations use data to make smart funding decisions. Nicole Lee from United Airlines shares how her company does disaster philanthropy. I want to welcome our studio audience. Thank you very much for coming out. Welcome to our YouTube audience, which sold out. I hope you, there's nobody on who would have been locked out because you wouldn't be here, but you may have come back. So I'm sorry if you got inconvenienced, if you were locked out. We had so many subscribers, we had to raise the cap, but glad you're with us. So many YouTubers, thanks so much for being with us. On Tony's Take Two, I want you to stay with the show. We're sponsored by Pursuant, full service fundraising, data-driven and technology-enabled. Tony.ma/Pursuant, capital P. Wegner CPAs, guiding you beyond the numbers, WegnerCPAs.com. By Telos, turning credit card processing into your passive revenue stream, Tony.ma/TonyTelos. And by Text to Give, mobile donations made easy, text NPR to 444-999. YouTubers, I want you to send us your questions. You can put them in the comments. We have somebody watching that stream. So by all means, you're part of the audience. Send in your questions, YouTubers, and we will get to you. Same thing with our studio audience. We'll be taking questions here too. I'm very glad to welcome our guests. Grace Sato is a knowledge services manager at Foundation Center. She analyzes data to describe trends and priorities in philanthropy. She's worked in the nonprofit sector for more than 15 years. Before researcher, she was a social worker in children and family services. Grace is seated right next to me. Nicole Lee is senior manager of corporate and community affairs for United Airlines in Chicago, Illinois. She's accountable for marketing, communications, and storytelling for the group, customer-facing charitable initiatives, and humanitarian aid and disaster response. She's worked in corporate social responsibility also for more than 15 years. I also want to welcome Phil. It's our friend here, Philanthropy. He's been getting shout outs. People have been wondering, what's that bear in the audience? Or, you know, the bear, Phil is no longer in the audience. He's on stage with us. Phil is standing here, sitting here. I don't know if you can see, but he's got a Foundation Center cap on. I don't know if YouTubers, you can make that out, but it's a Foundation Center cap. Join me in welcoming Philanthropy and Grace and Nicole. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you for having us.
Grace, I want to start with you. Knowledge services manager. What kind of knowledge are you accumulating?
We are accumulating knowledge about institutional philanthropy. And so, you know, nonprofits are often familiar with Foundation Center because of the grants data, and they're looking at it to identify potential funders for their areas of work. And internally, we're also looking at that data to talk about trends in the field of philanthropy. And we're able to analyze that data in lots of different ways, according to whatever the research question might be. And so today we're talking about disaster philanthropy, but it's a whole, you know, range of issue areas. And some of the things that I've worked on or I'm working on this year, you know, it can be funding for dance in the Chicago area, to funding for Latin and Central America, funding for young men of color. So, you know, whatever questions people might have about what philanthropy is doing in a certain area, we're able to look at our data to talk about that.
Is it foundations that come to you and ask you these specifics, like what's the state of funding dance in Chicago?
It often can be. The knowledge tools that we create tend to be funded. You know, we're a nonprofit just like others, and so
right.
We
Foundation
operate,
Center is a nonprofit.
Yeah, yep. We operate based on contracts and grants, and so it's often foundations that are funding us to do research in a specific area.
Okay, and then is it also initiatives on your own?
Yeah, we used to create these publications on like key facts on philanthropy, and we're going to go back to doing
like
that.
An annual report, like the
snapshot.
Giving USA.
Yeah, and we do provide data to Giving USA for for their sort of piece of the philanthropy data. So yeah, we do some of that. And we do, yeah, if there are specific issue areas, maybe not even related to the grants data, but we might do special work on topics that are of interest at the time.
And then how is this fed back to, I mean, I can see if it's a specific foundation or consortium asking, then obviously they're privy to the data. How about for the wider community? How do they access this?
Yeah, I mean, I would say that 90%, I don't know, that's just a number I'm throwing
large percentage.
Out. Large percentage.
Of
what we create funded by philanthropy is available to the public. So it becomes public knowledge that anyone can access. And especially when we're, you know, posting reports online or we're creating these websites that people can go to, it's often a nonprofit audience that's coming to use these tools.
Yeah. Okay. Is there one specific site people can go to see all the available research?
Yeah, we have a research collection on Issue Lab. I think it's called knowledgeservices.foundationcenter.org. I'll look that up during the break to see if that's actually correct.
Okay.
But so there is a collection of all of our research reports. You can go on our website at foundationcenter.org to see what other like online tools we have available.
Okay. Okay. Is it just U.S. philanthropy that you're measuring, or global as well? I mean, the disaster report is global.
It would be global. Yeah. We're getting a lot more global data. Like Foundation Center used to be very U.S. focused, but we have a lot of partnerships with other organizations where we're getting a lot more non-US donor data. And so increasingly what we're able to analyze isn't just about the US. And so the disaster philanthropy work that we're doing, we've done this annual report in partnership with the Center for Disaster Philanthropy for this will be our fifth year, but this is our first year in that time to actually say, let's just look at the whole universe of funding, not just limited to US foundations.
Okay. Donors as well as recipients,
right,
of course, international
exactly.
as well. Yeah. Okay.
So
when we move to the disaster philanthropy area, this is an annual, you've done this, what, like 3 or 4 years in a row now?
This year will be our fifth
year.
Report.
Okay. Yeah. And you're covering not only natural disasters, but humanitarian crises
right,
as well,
right.
Movement of people, refugees.
Yeah,
right?
And that's the kind of work we're able to do in partnership because we're sort of the experts on the data, but our funding partners or our partners, whoever they might be, are the experts in the issues that we're analyzing. And so when we first began working with the Center for Disaster Philanthropy, one of the first things we did was build this advisory committee to talk about like how do we want to look at the data around disasters. And so with this expert committee, we have this taxonomy that looks at the different disaster types. Before this work, we just sort of had a code for disasters, but now we're able to distinguish what's for a hurricane versus what's for a volcano and look at it in a more nuanced way. And yeah. Also specific to this project, they were like, we're not just interested in the type of disaster, but we're interested in where in the funding cycle are people giving? So there's a lot of giving going towards immediate response and relief, but how can we know what's being given for long-term recovery, who's giving for disaster preparedness? And so when we work in partnership, we're able to say, okay, well, this is how we can begin to code the data to look at those kinds of questions.
And how confident are you of what percentage of the data, of disaster giving you're able to capture?
Oh, that's a big question. So like Foundation Center's focus is on institutional philanthropy, but there's a whole lot of giving going out from individuals that we're not necessarily capturing. You know, we're able to say what is the US federal government doing through FEMA data and HUD data, but you know, countries are giving for disasters.
Yeah, I was gonna ask, does institutional include governments?
Yeah, and what we're able to do right now is track, you know, through the OECD, they're sort of measuring what's given from governments to governments or what's giving from multilateral institutions, and we're analyzing that data. But there's a whole world of data that's swimming out there, and so we're analyzing what we have access to at the moment.
Okay. Let's bring Nicole in, and then we're going to talk more about the Disaster Philanthropy Report. Nicole.
Hi.
Hey. Acquaint us with the philanthropy that United Airlines does.
Sure.
How does it react in this disaster response area?
Well, at United, we pride ourselves as an airline in preparing for emergencies, for aircraft emergencies specifically. So we've got a lot of experience and skills in those areas, and lends itself really well in the immediate aftermath of a natural disaster. And really, that's sort of where we have found a sweet spot for ourselves in terms of being able to leverage our assets, our network, our people, and our customers to respond to natural disasters. So really, since I've been with the company about 10 years now, I can think back to about 2011 was the first really major disaster that we responded to. It was the Japan earthquake and tsunami when the Fukushima power plant went down. And that impacted some of our people that were out there stationed at the airport. And we had an opportunity to provide assistance. And we look at each situation in isolation by itself. So really, what can we do to respond? How does it impact our operations and our employees and our customers? And what's the best way for us to add value to the situation? It's not every disaster that we respond with an aircraft. We have aircraft and we have the ability to get in where people might not be able to. But in some cases, the real power and value that we add is helping to stand up fundraising. So we'll run an online fundraising campaign and provide an incentive for our customers to donate cash to our disaster partners. We're well-versed enough to understand that the best thing that we can do in a disaster situation is to provide as much cash support as we can for the experts, all of the humanitarian aid partners that are out there and disaster response experts that know what they're doing, rather than doing coat drives and food drives. We understand that that's not a very productive way to respond to these disasters. So we do look at those factors.
And you were able to leverage the United resources to come in from Chicago for this
month. Yes,
today.
I was.
So thank you.
One of our many flights.
Thank you for doing that. Yeah, I see the boards. It's yours is the thin crust to deep dish.
Yes.
25 times a day.
That's right.
From New York to Chicago.
I had many options.
25 flights.
I did.
Giving a shout out on Unearned Media for United Airlines. Absolutely, absolutely. How do you decide? You know, as the company, let's make explicit, United Airlines doesn't have a foundation.
Correct. We
this
no longer have a corporate
directly
foundation.
From the corporation,
this,
right.
All of our corporate giving is done through our department, Corporate and Community Affairs. We continue to support many nonprofits and causes around the world through our department.
Is the response then primarily when it impacts United operations? You have hubs.
It's an important factor. I mean, I would be lying if I said that it wasn't. It absolutely
we understand
is
that.
An
it's
important
a corporation.
Factor. Yeah,
yeah,
it's a corporation. But we look at every situation in and of itself. So in the case of the Nepal earthquake or the Haiti earthquakes, those were two locations we didn't serve commercially. And with Haiti, we felt really compelled, given the state of the country, the really urgent need for assistance, and we were able to secure an aircraft. We were the first commercial airline to fly humanitarian flight into Port-au-Prince. And that really, I think, is a point of pride for me as a United employee. We focus on doing what's right, and when we can, and when it makes sense for us to do it, we do. And we ran humanitarian flights until the airport was open for commercial operations.
And when you say humanitarian flights, is that with flights that have aid
correct
packages?
So, we
or
brought
maybe people to
both.
Responders as
both
well?
Both, as a matter of fact. We are a passenger airline, but we carry quite a bit of cargo as well. So whatever we could fit in the bellies of these planes, we brought water, we brought medical supplies, we brought tents, we brought surgeons, we brought search and rescue, we brought experts in clean water. There were a lot of various volunteer groups that we opened up our aircraft to bring people in. And then we were part of the evacuation exercise as well. The military was in charge of the airport at the time, and there were droves of people who were looking to get off the island. And we flew those people out of Port-au-Prince into different places like Chicago or Newark. Just Chicago at the time, actually. I'm getting my time wrong here, but if they needed to get beyond Chicago, we took care of that too. We worked really closely with aid partners to make sure that individuals had what they needed when they got to their destination. So if we were flying them through Chicago, We had partners there ready to give them clothes because for a lot of folks, they didn't have anything but the shirts on their backs, waiting for a way out of the island.
Grace, do you find that local foundations will help in some kind of crisis, even if it's outside their mission? If they're devoted to funding, or we use dance or arts or social services or something, that's not related to humanitarian relief directly, but they'll step up anyway.
Yeah, I mean, I think when a disaster hits an area, it affects everyone and everything. So even if your focus is like the arts, your artists are going to be impacted by that disaster. And yeah. So one of the things that our partner, the Center for Disaster
right.
Philanthropy,
people are impacted.
Yeah,
there might be students,
say, yes.
They might be the homeless.
Right.
Whoever it is you're helping, they're
yeah,
impacted.
There's a need there.
Differently than your mission.
Exactly. Yeah. And it's not common to hear a foundation describe themselves as a disaster funder. Like, there aren't that many that would say that's what we do. But when a crisis happens, every funder becomes in some way a disaster funder. They're going to be doing something to address that crisis. And so one of the things we hope is that as we keep talking about it and as we keep bringing data and best practices, funders will start to think of themselves a little bit differently so that they'll make funding decisions that will really make an impact on in helping whatever yeah. population they're trying to serve.
Do you find that, not sure how to word this, foundations must be relying on local partners. How do they determine who they're going to partner with in the midst of a crisis?
Yeah, I mean,
you can't have partners set up everywhere,
right?
Certainly in the country or even in the world,
right?
How do they make those decisions? Who to partner with?
Yeah.
The day of a crisis, the day after a crisis.
Yeah, I mean, it can depend on the funder. If the funder focuses on a specific region, they might have relationships with the nonprofits that are working on the ground. But often, if that doesn't happen, yeah. and a foundation wants to give to kind of a topic that you talked about a couple weeks ago on community philanthropy, it's often the community foundations that are building some kind of response and recovery fund that larger foundations will give to. And Nicole, you can probably speak more to that. But kind of with the understanding that these community
you just stole
foundations.
My next question. Oh, sorry.
Yeah.
It's fine.
Yeah.
No, it's
ahead.
Fine. Anarchy on set.
She wants your job. So yeah,
somebody wanted the job last week too. Who was that? Paul, what was that guy? Thought he was set for interviewing. And then he botched something. He got all confused. He lost his point. He said, oh wait, I forgot what I was thinking. I forgot what I was going to say. So Stuart. Wasn't that Stuart?
Stuart Post.
Yeah, Stuart Post. And then, so I bailed him out. So he realized he was not qualified to be a host.
Let you do your job.
Okay.
Yeah,
I'll stop then. Yeah. So how do you do that, Nicole? What do you do in a crisis? Do you go to community foundations or if it's international? How do you choose the local partners to give, oftentimes it's cash,
yeah.
as you said?
Sure. So we do, like I said, rely heavily on our global partners. But at the same time, we rely on our folks that are on the ground, our government affairs and international regulatory
employees throughout the world. Yeah.
So I can point to a really great example of this with the community foundations is with California wildfires. At the end of last year, beginning of this year, we ran a few fundraisers and really looking to make sure that the dollars are staying local, giving our customers options to provide funding for various different size organizations. We partnered with Shasta Regional Community Foundation as well as North Coast Opportunities most recently and really got those recommendations through our community relations staff person who's on the ground in San Francisco and working through our government affairs folks that are on the ground as well.
Let's see, Grace, let's go dive in a little deeper to the disaster philanthropy report. Now, you two met when the report was being released, is that
correct.
Right? Yeah.
You were
in love with the report.
We're really old friends. And, yes.
Okay.
No,
last
we are.
Year this
yeah,
time.
We yes, it was about this time
yeah.
last year.
Okay. I mean, give us a top one or two takeaways, top points that
yeah.
people, I mean, we're going to direct people to the report. That report
yes.
is available too.
Yes.
But let's start with what are a couple of major points?
Yeah. Right. So it's based on kind of the annual analysis that we do called the State of Disaster Philanthropy. And because of the nature of the data that we're working with, we don't say we have a complete year set of data. until maybe about 2 years after the fact. So like this year we're releasing a report in November, and that will be about the 2016.
2016, right, because this is 2017. The current report is from 2015. Is a report,
so the one that we met about, was 2015. Yeah. So we're always a little bit, you know, behind, because you just need enough data, and the way we are able to get data can take time to collect. But I would say maybe the main takeaway from the work that we've been doing is probably really intuitive, but it kind of, it gives the analysis to support what one would already imagine to be true, which is that the majority of funding for disasters happens for the immediate response and relief effort. And there's not enough funding going towards the mid to long-term recovery, and there's not enough funding for preparedness for communities and sort of making communities resilient.
So the before and the long-term after, midterm and long-term after. Yeah, you know, it's hard. You know, the cameras go away.
Exactly.
The next news item comes up, and people in that region, whether they're refugees or it's a tsunami, you know, they're suffering for years.
Yeah.
But the attention of the world moves on.
Yeah.
The needs linger.
Right. And I think that's also where like the local partners, the community foundations, are really important, because they're there to stay. You know, they're part of that community. And so they'll be able to see the needs for the long term. And I think that's also why they're important partners in this work, because they're, I think, maybe able to address and see and feel the sort of longer term impact of these disasters and address them.
And try to keep attention focused. Right. I guess the attention of funders, you're not going to get the attention of the media unless it's the anniversary. You know, the media likes to come back the year later, the 2 years later, what's the progress, you know, et cetera. But in the meantime, funder attention needs to be, Nicole, is United able to help in the midterm and long term after a disaster?
Or we are, really? So we are able to, and I think, you know, having listened to the presentation and of the report last year was really eye-opening for us, and it really did sort of reinforce what we've been experiencing ourselves in terms of seeing the need for more preparedness and resiliency for a very long time. We found our niche really to be in the immediate aftermath, and hadn't really considered what the opportunities were to continue helping with rebuilding and resiliency, and really looking at the other side of that with preparedness. And really, I think with Hurricane Harvey last year, I think it really hit home to us with Harvey hitting right in the heart of Houston. With 12,000 employees there, we felt it very acutely with our own families that were living there, and our operations being impacted, and the communities that we really cared about. So I think post Harvey, we really started to look at what other partnerships we could we can engage in, and with partners, with our disaster relief partners, what are they doing in terms of preparedness and resiliency? So it's looking at the landscape of our partnerships to see what it is they're doing. We really trusted our partners to be the experts. You know, it's not our business to be disaster philanthropy and disaster response experts. We really look at ourselves as really strong partners to help empower and enable our nonprofit partners to do what they do best. Really lean on them to do that.
And then, of course, to the extent that it's cash that you're giving from the from the customer campaigns, you know, that if that's to the community foundation, then there's, you know, there's a contribution to the midterm and long term. Yeah, Grace, were you going to say something?
Yeah, I was just going to say, and there's something to be said about just foundations being prepared for how they will respond the next time. I guess you probably built up a body of experience that you say when the next thing happens, we kind of know we don't want to do this, we want to do this, and having, I don't know, there's like a different level of preparedness for philanthropy too, to themselves be ready for how they will respond to the next disaster. And one of the things I heard recently was that for community foundations, it's really important for them to have a mechanism for individuals to give to their fund, because after like 3 to 4 days, the donations will peter out.
Yeah, isn't some like a third comes in the first 3 to 4 days, and then the remaining two thirds come within like 2 weeks or something, or 3 weeks or something? It's very short.
It is, and so often when community foundations are building these response recovery funds, they actually need to have that set up as soon as the disaster happens, because people will want to give in that short
set up in advance
time.
So that it can be activated and promoted.
And one of the stories was that from the Puerto Rico disaster last year, the community foundation didn't have a mechanism in place. And so it was sort of a cautionary tale for community foundations just to be ready. And of course, you know, then they had their electric power grid go out. And so so there's a level of preparedness for institutions. There's a level of preparedness for individuals and, you know, sort of equipping people to be ready. But yeah, the preparedness happens in all sorts of different ways, I think.
Yeah.
And I can comment on that if I can offer something really quickly, just sort of based on everything that happened last year with Harvey, Irma, and Maria, and then there was an earthquake in Mexico City. More and more, we're seeing weather events that are severe and needing assistance. Mm. And one of the things that came out of that experience last year was really within our company, at least, coming together with our business continuity, emergency response, human resources, and community affairs teams to come up with a playbook. So you talked about preparedness. I mean, we are much better prepared based on the learnings from last year, you know, with wanting to provide as much care for our employees and customers as possible, and balancing that with the resources that we have and what's realistic. So now we've spent the better part of the last year putting together a playbook that has, frankly, just ready menu items that we can deploy and that we're ready to do. We're ready to deploy and activate on within, you know, 24 hours of an incident. But we also have a framework that allows us to evaluate what we want to deploy. And this year, in fact, with our fundraising, so I'm glad that you brought that up in terms of the number as well. We do disaster fundraising campaigns with our customers. And this year was the first time that we did a general disaster relief call out to our customers. We're looking at Florence at the time, and there were about five other severe weather there was Typhoon Manku out in the Pacific, right. And we actually have a lot of operations out there as well, and impacted our customers and our employees. And we're a global company, and to run separate campaigns for every single one of these was not realistic, and it's not helpful to our aid partners as well. You know, if we put up a campaign for one incident, and then there's two that come right behind it, now we've sort of sucked all the money up out of donations, and these organizations don't have the flexibility because they accepted money for a specific incident. So in really providing the most flexibility to our aid partners to do what they do best.
Is it a general disaster relief campaign?
Yeah, it's a general disaster relief campaign that's running through the end of October right now, where we're offering our customers who donate $50 or more bonus miles, thanking them for their contributions, because we know.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Oh, I didn't see that.
Yes.
Oh.
You can earn up to 1,000 miles, Tony.
Okay. Cool.
I'll give you the link later.
Yeah. Well, can you, now I have an in.
Oh,
I mean,
yes.
Can you give me like a double match or something? So I can,
we'll see what we can
do. Can I get 3,000 for the 50?
We'll wait till the mics are off.
Okay. All right. We have, do we have any questions? Let's start with our studio audience. Any, I'm pre-prepared. I have candy as an inducement to question asking. You will get one of these Lifesavers candies. Any questions? Any questions here? Anything on our live stream? Any questions? Okay. YouTubers, don't forget. You know, I can't send you candy. I can show it to you. I can tease you with it, but I cannot dole it out. Sorry. But ask your questions, YouTubers. Let's see. This seems like a good time. We'll got to do a little business. Okay? Got to do a little business. Pursuant. Their newest ebook is Fast Nonprofit Growth, Stealing from the Startups. They take secrets from the fastest growing corporate startups and apply those methods and good practices to your nonprofit work. The resource is free, just like all the Pursuant resources are, and it's on the listener landing page, which is at tony.ma/pursuant, with a capital P for please, or I guess it could be for Pursuant, but use the capital P. Wegner, CPAs, there's a new accounting rule on how you account for contributions. Is it a contribution or is it an exchange transaction? You don't have to know. That's the beauty of this. Wegner has you covered. You start at wegnercpas.com and then talk to the partner, Yeet Uchtun. And if you're here in the audience, you can talk to him right now because he's going to raise his hand. There he is. There's one of our sponsors, Yeet, CPA. He's here. You can ask him about this new rule. And then after you go to wegnercpas.com, or you do it live here, then talk to Yeet about your 990 and your audit. WegnerCPAs.com. Telos, credit card processing. You've heard me read the testimonials from nonprofits that have referred businesses to Telos for credit card processing. Those nonprofits are getting a long tail of passive revenue because each month, 50% of the fees from the card processing go to you, to your nonprofit. That's that long tail of passive revenue. You've heard me read the testimonials from the businesses that are using Telos for their credit card processing. The way to get started, watch the video. It's at the listener landing page, tony.ma/TonyTelos. Text to give. Have you got your phone? You need your phones handy for this one? You've heard about mobile donations. You've been thinking about it. It's time to find out. Get the info. Text to give makes it very simple and it's affordable. You don't have to be a techie. There's no technical skills required because Text to Give will talk you through a very simple process. They help you each step of the way. It's not expensive. The way to get the info, finally, you've been thinking about it. The way to get the info, the number is 444-999 and you text NPR for Nonprofit Radio. NPR to 444-999. Tony's Take Two. My gratitude again to the Foundation Center for hosting us all this month. It's Nonprofit Radio Month at the Foundation Center, and it's been Foundation Center Month on Nonprofit Radio. Wrapping it up today, so glad and so grateful that they hosted us for the month. Lots of gratitude. Thank you, Foundation Center. And we're already talking about next year. If you want to stay with Nonprofit Radio, we're not going to be at the Foundation Center starting next week, but you can stay with Nonprofit Radio. The way to get info on the show, every Friday, there's a live stream at 1 o'clock Eastern, but of course it's a podcast. You can listen anytime you like at your leisure. The way to get the info is go to tonymartinetti.com. You can sign up for insider alerts. You'll know who the guests are each week through one email. Or just subscribe. Just subscribe. You can do it all at tonymartinetti.com. I hope you're going to stay with us after we leave the Foundation Center. This has been a great place, but the show has to go on, and they can't host us every single Friday. It's asking a bit much. We got to send the live listener love. So the live listener love goes to, of course, our YouTube stream and our live audience here. Thank you again, both audiences. Thank you for being with us. The podcast Pleasantries, that's where the vast majority of the audience is, over 13,000 listeners each week. Whatever time, whatever device you're listening on, Pleasantries to the podcast audience. And the affiliate affections go out to our AM and FM affiliates throughout the country. Lots of community radio stations carrying Nonprofit Radio. So grateful to your stations for doing that and grateful to you for listening on those AM and FM stations. Terrestrial radio, it's going nowhere. It's not gonna die. Podcasting is not gonna kill AM, FM radio. It's not gonna happen. Affections to our affiliate audiences. Okay. Back to Grace Sato, Knowledge Services Manager at the Foundation Center, and Nicole Lee, Senior Manager of Corporate and Community Affairs for United Airlines. Let's see, where should we go? What intrigued you about, Nicole, about the disaster philanthropy report? What drew you to this whole idea?
First of all, I didn't actually know it existed. We'd been out of the foundation game for a little bit, so I wasn't necessarily paying attention. But
so there had been a United Foundation?
There had been a United Foundation at one point, and we've changed over. So we do all the corporate giving, as I said, through our department, Corporate and Community Affairs. And what really drew me to want to hear about the report was just really to see what the state of disaster philanthropy giving was. I wanted to see what the rest of the world was doing and to look for opportunities potentially for where United could get involved as well. I think one of the great things that this resource really does is that, well, it exists, which is amazing because, you know, individual companies and foundations can't do that on their own. And it's really, really invaluable information because it reinforces funding decisions. While it wasn't driving funding decisions for us, it absolutely reinforced the direction that we were headed.
Okay, cool. What else can we, so we talked about preparedness, not enough resources devoted to the before, and the midterm and long-term after. in need of resources. So that's all right. So important takeaways. What else? What's another lesson we can draw from the state of disaster philanthropy as it in the 2017 report as it existed in 2015?
I'll talk a little bit. We do have a report. It's a static report. People can look
at. Where can
it's
we get? All right, so where do we get that?
So everything that we do related to disaster philanthropy is at disasterphilanthropy.foundationcenter.org. But in addition to the report, we do have a web portal sort of, where people can actually dig into the data in a way that they're interested in looking at it. And so one of the things we have is a funding map. And it's visualizing the data that feeds the report so that you can actually see what's behind it, like who are the funders giving to, what are the size of the grants, who are they giving to, what are the smaller grants that are going out there. And so, one of the things that Foundation Center has been doing more of over the last couple of years is not just producing static reports, because they get published, they're true for that moment in time, but there's so much else that continues to change and things that people are learning and grants data that continue to be distributed. And so with something like a mapping platform, we're behind in sort of the years, but we're still getting new data. And so that gets pushed onto the platform so people can see what's the latest that we have, at least. And with something like an online tool, you can then drill down to see what are partners that you might not have had on your radar that other people are giving to that you might be interested in. If you're trying to get a sense for what's going on locally, you can see, some of the smaller organizations that might not get that might not have a national reputation, but they might be doing good work in a specific area.
Yeah, everybody thinks, Red Cross first.
Yes.
First.
They're always the largest recipient, but there's so many organizations doing lots of good work, and so we hope that with these online tools, that will get lifted up a little bit more. And then the other thing is that it highlights the gaps in the funding. By seeing where the money is going, you can also see what's not getting funded as much. And so some of that is related to, the way that we do the work around disaster philanthropy, but it beyond sort of the disaster philanthropy analysis, for any kind of research project that we do, it highlights where funding isn't going, how it compares with other groups, and so we hope that through that, funders will then say, I only have this limited amount of dollars to give for this area, so how do I make that count more by giving it to an area that's not funded as much?
Are you seeing any shifts? Now you've been doing it for 5 years. You could potentially see shifts. Are you seeing more devoted to the preparedness and the medium and long term?
Than
initially,
right.
5 years ago? Not really.
What I'm seeing is that it really depends year by year.
I keep touching Phil's ear. I'm sorry. First of all, I forgot to give a shout out to Phil. I didn't realize he has a tag on still. He's totally unprepared. And I keep touching his ear. It's nothing, it's nothing sensual. Right? I can't help it. My hand just naturally falls there. I'm sorry. Okay. Sorry, Phil. Sorry. Grace.
It's fine. I think with the disaster work, so much of it is dependent on what disaster occurred in that year.
All
and
right.
So there was the year where the response was so high was the year that Ebola outbreak was huge, and that was largely driven by
funders. What year was that?
That was in, 2014, and then it sort of trickled into 2015, but mainly 2014.
Okay.
And so when you get a big funder like the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, this is their area of work, right? Health.
Health, yeah.
And so when there's a disaster that sort of meets that area that they're really interested in, they were giving a huge amount for that response and relief effort. And then the next year, they were continuing to fund, but then they're starting to look at, how do we build up resiliency in these African countries for the next outbreak? And so one huge foundation can drive the trends, because they're giving so much money. And so that in 2015, then there was a lot more going for risk reduction, resilience, that kind of work because of the Gates funding for the Ebola kind of area of work. So I think it's too soon to say that there's a trend, overall trend for making different funding decisions. And it still continues to be episodic, I think.
Okay. Nicole, can you say a little more about what United is able to do? midterm and long term, or is it really just? You, I guess you had already said.
Yeah, so all of that gets done through our partners,
immediate,
right? With our ongoing global partnerships, we have a great partnership with a group called AirLink that provides, they're like a matching service basically for NGOs and nonprofits who are looking for cargo or passenger lift into different disaster areas to do humanitarian work or disaster response, and really rely on partners like them to know where the need is most. So we provide travel and they leverage our travel to get people there. So with the Ebola outbreak, I think in some cases we were flying, you know, responders into the area. I believe at some point we also flew some medication. So on a smaller scale, and that was sort of outside the US. And I think back then we were much more domestically focused. But now we've absolutely begun to grow sort of more of our global reach.
I'll speak to the data a little bit too. Like one of the limitations in how we're able to analyze.
Is the data at disasterphilanthropy.foundationcenter.org, or that's where the report is?
You can see all of it there.
You can
get access to the reports. You can see the map. You can see we have like a dashboard that gives like analysis that you can sort of drill down.
Okay, so that's all at disasterphilanthropy.foundationcenter.org. Okay, please go ahead.
Yeah, so you know, one of the limitations on doing any analysis is the quality of the data that you have.
Yeah.
And so we're doing this analysis based on kind of the best available data, which often isn't that descriptive. You know, a lot of Foundation Center's data is coming from 990 forms because foundations are required to report their grants data. And so when there's not enough description, it's really hard to say, like in a nuanced way, how much funding is really going towards these specific areas of a disaster, you know, disaster work. And so one of the things that we're always trying to get foundations to do is to share better data with us so that we're able to be more descriptive in what the actual landscape is. And so
is there a reason that a foundation would be unwilling to share data?
You know, I think there's a growing movement for foundations to be more transparent and, you know, to...
Yeah, well, that's true sector-wide.
Yeah.
So why would they give you a stiff arm? What would be some reasons not to?
You know, it depends on the type of foundation it could be. You know, there's so many very, very small foundations that may not be staffed, they may not have the capacity to share that data.
To answer a survey.
That someone has to do. And you know, some foundations may want to stay kind of under the radar too. One of the things that you hear in disaster philanthropy is that corporations may not want to talk about the work they're doing because they don't want to get solicitations for funding. They don't have the bandwidth to address, you know, calls coming in for help. So there could be reasons why, but the thing that we try to encourage is that foundations can tell their story, you know, and own that story through their data. Like they can sort of narrate how they're giving, why they're giving through that data, and they can say it the way they want to. Otherwise, people may read their 990 and come to their own conclusions. And so we do have a number of foundations who voluntarily give their data to us, and that's one way we're able to get more current data, but I think just we're always sort of in the search for better data too.
Okay. Nicole, what are you seeing generally, you know, beyond United, just among your peers, in other corporate social responsibility? What kind of trends are you seeing?
I think, you know, obviously with the number of disasters that companies are having to respond to, and sort of the clip with which it's being covered in the news, also drives people's propensity to respond to them. So I think we're having to be a lot smarter about how we're using the limited resources that we have. Obviously, working inside of a corporation, we're stewards of the available funding, and we're also still running a business. We're making investments in communities and trying to make smart ones, and the data absolutely helps to drive that as well.
Yeah, so it's not necessarily the event or episode
right.
that gets the most attention from
absolutely.
The media that deserves the great... proportional funding
yeah,
to
absolutely.
The coverage.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, one of the things that we've done at United over the last year and a half or so is really get into what the critical needs in each of our major markets are. So where our our biggest presence. So here in the East Coast, New York and New Jersey and Houston, post Harvey, was a big investment that was made in a in the Greater Houston Food Bank as a direct result of what happened with Hurricane Harvey. So we see decisions like that being made. And I think overall people in my line of work are really looking with a keen eye to see where they can best leverage the resources that they have. You know, when you are not the Exxon Mobils or Apples of the world, you get really creative. And we have really found a great opportunity to work with our customers, our very generous customers, to collectively work together to fund disasters. To fund disaster relief. I shouldn't say fund disasters. We don't want to be part of a disaster. That is not what we want to do. But to fund disaster response and really to bring the most help where it's needed as quickly as possible and as efficiently as possible.
Grace, are you finding that there's more reliance on data? I don't know, are you getting more requests today than you did many years ago? I mean, you're doing the disaster philanthropy report just for 5 years, but you've been researching long before then. Are you finding a greater reliance, greater interest in data-driven decision making?
I might feel that we are, but it could be just because last year's disaster season was so dramatic. There were so many disasters taking place in a really concentrated period of time at the end of 2017. And so we got a lot of journalists, you know, wanting to report on this and what is philanthropy doing. So we were getting a lot of requests for data. And that's one thing that I will mention is that, you know, the analysis that we do every year is based on, you know, 2 year old data. But because we know that there is a lot of interest in real time, like there's a disaster occurring right now, what are funders doing? We have, I have a colleague, his name is Andrew, and he begins to sort of scour the news sources and the PR newswires just to see what are foundations and corporations announcing about their giving for a specific disaster. And so we're able to then get a picture of what people are doing as it happens. Yeah. So we've done that with Hurricane Florence on our news site, PND, Philanthropy News Digest. There's a blog tracking Hurricane Florence with kind of who do we know are the biggest donors so far. And you can actually open up a spreadsheet to see what we found based on these new sources.
All right, so I own two homes in North Carolina. So who are the biggest funders so far?
Knew I'd be asked this. Right now, what we have is Walmart gave, I think, $5 million. Lowe's committed another $2 or $3 million. And I'm going to forget who the third one is now. But yeah.
All right, well, if it occurs to you, shout them out. All right, thank you. I was going to ask something, I forgot. See, even I forget. It's not Stuart Post is not the only one who loses train of thought.
I can say one more thing.
Go ahead. Help me out. Yeah, bail me out.
Yeah. Like you were mentioning a playbook that you have now. Mm-hmm. And so one of the things I feel like I should bring up is that our partner, the Center for Disaster Philanthropy, also has a playbook. This is like...
I know what it was. Okay. Go ahead.
Go ahead. And
I remember.
This is meant to be a resource for philanthropy. Like, if you want to do strategic, smart philanthropy, what should you know? Oh, disaster philanthropy, what should you know? What have other funders learned? What are case studies of things that went well? You know, so there's this whole place that you can go. It's called the Disaster Playbook, Disaster Philanthropy Playbook.
.com?
Our funders are disasterphilanthropy.org, and you can find it there.
Disasterphilanthropy.org. Mm-hmm. You'll find the playbook there.
Yes.
Okay. And what I was going to ask you was, how about broader, forget about disaster philanthropy, just go broader. Are you seeing any greater interest in data-driven decision-making? Your work is not just disaster philanthropy, that's just one report.
Right.
You're collecting all kinds of data. Are foundations being any smarter today than they were 10 years ago about funding decisions?
I think there's a greater interest in data. Whether and how that's driving decisions is probably specific to foundations. I think that within philanthropy, there's a lot of strides that are being made to, like, how do we measure our impact? You know, like, how do we know we're making a difference?
Yeah.
And measuring that can
that's
be very,
wide.
Yeah, it can be very, it's hard, it's not easy. And so I think there are a lot of hard conversations about that. And I think from Foundation Center's data point of view, one of the important things I think we can do is begin to benchmark at least what's happening. You know, like, we wouldn't have done this disaster philanthropy analysis without a partner that was willing to say, we want to know what the sector looks like in this way. And so once you sort of set a benchmark, then you're able to follow it over time and see if you're making a difference. And so I think that benchmarking piece is probably important for a lot of areas. Like, I've done that with funding for Black men and boys. You know, there was a partner, initially it was Open Society Foundations. They had a campaign for Black male achievement, and they wanted to say very specifically, what is philanthropy doing for African American men and boys? And we had never kind of done research on that. So our first kind of report was, what does it look like? What's going on? And then from there on, year after year, we're able to sort of track how the progress is going. And also then identify, is the funding starting to dip? You know, there was sort of this swell of interest, and foundations were, you know, getting really involved and funding really in a targeted way this specific population. But, you know, we're able to sort of see the trends of whether or not that's sustained and growing, or whether that starts to dip after a while.
Okay. Nicole, are you able to hold your partners accountable? I mean, or are you relying more on the local organizations for outcomes, you know, and impact analysis? Are you able to do that yourselves, or?
We do rely on our partners a lot to do that. I mean, again, we're in the airline business, so we get people safely from point A to point B. So we do rely on our partners to do that. And as far as how we...
But you also want to make sure the money is obviously being spent efficiently.
Yeah, and we evaluate that on an annual basis. And we look at what they're producing in terms of outcomes, the number of people that they're reaching, you know, if they have studies going on sort of the long-term impact of their programs. So we have four major giving areas that we're focused on: lifting up communities in crisis after disasters, one of them, breaking down barriers and promoting inclusion, really wanting to build a more inclusive society, inspiring the next generation of leaders, which is really STEM focused, with being a technical industry and the shortage of pilots and qualified people. You know, we're really looking to make sure that as many young people as possible, especially young girls, as well as socioeconomic.
We only have about a minute left.
Sure. Sorry. So yes, we do hold them accountable, because we have conversations, and we're in a constant conversation about where we can have a bigger impact.
Okay. So glad to see, you know, reliance on data as much as, but we need more. It sounds like Grace is saying we could use more. Any questions? We got any questions? Start with our live studio audience in studio. No questions. We're channeling the audience so well that there's not a single question. All questions have been anticipated.
Have you perceived any difference in how a foundation makes its grant-making decisions versus how a CSR program or corporate giving program might make its philanthropic decisions?
So I haven't really worked in a traditional foundation setting.
Here goes the candy.
I have friends that do. I want to say, though, that I think that the main difference in terms of the driver of the decisions really is, you know, looking at... Obviously, the foundations are stewards of their funds as well, and they want to invest those in a smart way. With corporate giving, I think you've got the nuance of looking at where you can also have reputational benefits as well, and where you can have the biggest impact in interacting and engaging with both customers who lend to your funding as well, because customers have a big influence over your ability to give. So we take that responsibility very seriously, and look to find the best partners and, you know, most effective ways to create the biggest impact with the resources that we have. If that answers your question.
All right, we're going to the giveaways, because I know the live stream does not have any questions. So we're going to the giveaways. You're going to need your phone. You're going to need your phone. YouTubers, of course, you are included in this. You're going to be texting for books. We're texting for, this is a very literate, nonprofit radio is a very literate audience. We're giving away books. I've got four different books as prizes this week, all right? But only one prize per person, please. So if you're a winner, then you have to step out the next time. And the system will catch you. So don't try to game the system. Okay, first one, the first five people, did my voice just crack? I think it did. Five people, first five people to text are going to win this book, This is Modern Media Relations for Nonprofits. First of all, of course, you need the number. So here's the number, 252-515-7987. See, some of you are not texting. All right, you're not in it. You're not literate. I thought Nonprofit Radio was 100% literate audience. All right. 252-515-7987. So this first book, Modern Media Relations for Nonprofits, is written by Peter Panapento and Antoinette Kerr. They were on the show just last month. They walk you through the details, how to set up and be eligible for earned media, paid media, and your owned media, the stuff you have in your own toolbox. How to start relationships with journalists. How to be media friendly so that journalists can find you. All right, so you got the number, 252-515-7987. What else to cover? Oh, how to position yourself as a thought leader. Yes, so that reporters want to talk to you about the subject matter that you're expert in. All right, the book is brand new. And here's what you text. All right, you text data. Some of you are not in it. I'm sorry to see that. We got plenty of YouTubers. All right, that's what you do. You text data to that number. All right, next book. Next one is, I didn't bring a copy of everything. It's too many books to carry. The next one is, I have just one copy of this one. One copy, one winner this time. It's Braided Threads, A Historical Overview of the American Nonprofit Sector by Dr. Robert Penna. He was also on the show just last month. How did the social sector get here? How did we come to look the way we do? It's a history. First person to text, same number. Oh, I should have said, same number. You got it? 252-515-7987, same number. You text threads for Braided Threads. All right, third book, also one winner, same number. It's the same number. This one is You, Us, and Them, LinkedIn Marketing Concepts for Nonprofits. I see some people now. Oh, now you're jumping in. Well, because you want this book, but you didn't get the number. So you didn't get it in the beginning. All right, it's 252-515-7987 for the LinkedIn book. This is going to one person. You text LinkedIn. And the final one. This is really the biggest seller of the four. This one is New Power, the book by Henry Timms, the CEO at the 92nd Street Y. New Power. I saw this on a bookshelf in an airport. Last chance. I have one copy of New Power to give away, and you text, same number, Henry. The name Henry. Text it now. That's it. Okay, those are the giveaways. Next week, we're not going to be at the Foundation Center. Sad. We got to say goodbye to the Foundation Center. But you can still be with us, of course. Go to TonyMartinetti.com for the info. And next week, we're talking about the State of Good 2018 Nonprofit Survey and also your brand personality. That's next week on Nonprofit Radio. If you missed any part of today's show, I beseech you, find it on TonyMartinetti.com. We're sponsored by Pursuant, online tools for small and mid-sized nonprofits, data-driven and technology-enabled. Tony.ma/Pursuant, capital P. Wegner CPAs, guiding you beyond the numbers. Go to WegnerCPAs.com. By Telos, credit card and payment processing, your passive revenue stream. Tony.ma/TonyTelos. And by Text to Give, mobile donations made easy. Tony.ma. No, that's not a Tony.ma. See, I get so carried away. It's like so total narcissism. No, for Text to Give, you text NPR to 444-999. Our creative producer is Claire Meyerhoff. The show's social media is by Susan Chavez. Mark Silverman is our web guy. And this music is by Scott Stein of Brooklyn. Many thanks to Tracy Kaufman, Susan Shiroma, and William Lee at the Foundation Center. Thank you so much for keeping us going this whole month, all three of you. Be with me next week for Nonprofit Radio, big nonprofit ideas for the other 95%. Go out and be great.